Majin Waha Wintra na Galva, agus Falchgadí Gawa talks Lum Hain John Morley, ag chat the new sir and Glóra Nyov, no. An opportunity for volunteers to contribute to the future of palliative care services. There is a need for better supports for young LGBTQ plus people in Galway. Sabina Higgins to light a candle for the children of Gaza. More wastewater treatment services are needed in Ardwan. Event for Gaza in Spittle. Galway celebrates National Day of Youth Creativity. We have financial advice with Dave McCarthy. Wilder Wellbeing's May mental health campaign gets underway. And we also have the Spirit of Revolution book on History Talks. All this and a whole lot of more topics coming up on Galway Talks. Good morning. You're listening to Galway Talks and I'm John Morley, and if you want to get involved in the programme today, do so on our text and WhatsApp number. That's 086 38 33 553. You can phone Siobhan on reception on 091 77 0077, and email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. Now, the All-Ireland Institute of Hospice and Palliative Care is offering a unique opportunity for members of the public to help to shape the future of palliative care services across the island of Ireland. AIIHPC is looking for new volunteers to join Voices for Care, which is a volunteer group established to include and to learn from the personal experiences of palliative care of its members. Members of Voices for Care are people with life-limiting illness who may have palliative care needs, carers or former carers of people with palliative care needs, and members of the public with an interest in palliative care. To discuss this further, I'm joined by Brendan Kennelly of Voices for Care. Brendan, good morning. It's an interesting group and they do great volunteer work, and it's an important sector to get the grasp of people's personal experiences and their views as well.
Good morning, John. Yes, I think it is really important. It's such a sensitive area, and to have a group that involves and includes people with their own life-limiting illnesses, but more likely carers of people who have such illnesses, or indeed former carers. But there's also a third category of people who are very welcome in the group, and that's members of the general public who are interested in palliative care.
And you fall into that section. What got you involved in Voices for Care?
Well, a couple of different things. One was I was helping a family member who at the time was receiving palliative care. But I suppose more broadly than that, I was interested in various issues around end-of-life care, but in particular the possibility of non-medical support for people in their at the end of their lives.
Okay, now Voices for Care, talk to me about the work they actually do, because it's not really a steering group, it's a volunteer group that informs different bodies.
That's right, yeah. So the All-Ireland Institute run a number of different themes, or have a number of different work streams, and much of that is in research and much of that is in education. So our work is often as an advisory, in an advisory role to different projects, different research projects, different education projects, or different public engagement projects, where the person who coordinates us in the All-Ireland Institute, a wonderful person called Paula Pinto, she will send out an email and she'll say, look, there's a researcher in Galway or in Dublin and they have a particular project and they're looking for a couple of people to help them with that project. And she'll say, give it an open invitation to us to get involved or not. So there's a great variety of roles that you can play. There's no great pressure on you to do everything. Certainly nobody could do everything. There's about 40 or 50 people in Voices for Care at any one time. And they have a nice mix of people, including mix of people with experience. So you serve a 4-year term, but every 2 years they bring on some new people. So the new people coming on, they might work alongside a person who knows the ropes, if you like.
Okay, I know you've advised a number of research projects that were coordinated by the All-Ireland Institute of Hospice and Palliative Care. Talk me through some of them, just give us a flavour.
Sure, so for example, there's one at the moment that I'm involved in. It's a special interest group that's looking at this, at the delivery of emotional and spiritual support to people at the end of their lives. So that's an All-Ireland group, and that's a really interesting aspect, that we have people from Northern Ireland and the Republic who are interested in that topic. A second very good example for me was a couple of years ago, there was a steering group that developed a new national palliative care policy for Ireland, and there was various consultants and various researchers and various hospice providers in that group. And there was two people in from Voices for Care, myself and another person were invited to be part of that group. So that was really interesting because you were right there at the coalface of seeing how a new policy was developed.
Mm. I know you also organised very successful public events for Palliative Care Week in 2019 and 2020. Talk us through that side of things.
Well, I was very lucky in 2019. There was this wonderful woman, Catherine Mannix, who happened to be in Galway for a conference, and I piggybacked on that, asked her would she do a public event. And in fact, not alone did she do a public event, but she did a wonderful interview with your predecessor, Keith, and they had a great chat. So that was a fantastic event. She's written a tremendous book called With the End in Mind, which is a book that tries to show that, you know, dying may not be as awful as many of us think it will be or might be. And then in the following year, I organised an event that we were in the pandemic then, and it was palliative care in the pandemic with a wonderful consultant, Dr. Miriam Colleran, who's works in the NACE hospice. And she spoke to us online about her experiences during the pandemic and how to deliver high quality palliative care in really difficult circumstances.
I know you've also represented Voices for Care on a steering group that's overseeing the development of a new palliative care policy for Ireland. What kind of things are ye looking for from the Voices for Care group in that policy?
So So one thing is, I suppose, you know, you can imagine that sitting around a room, there's a lot of people who are, you know, really knowledgeable about the topic. That's their day-to-day work. And so I think for what they look for us from us is, you know, what does, you know, the ordinary person think? And I suppose we're not just ordinary people, we're people who are interested in the topic. My colleague who was on the group with me, she herself has had some really interesting and intense experience of an end-of-life situation in her family. And she spoke really movingly and directly to the group around that issue.
Mm. Now, I know another area you were very involved in is that you represented Voices for Care in the Irish Hospice Foundation project that resulted in the position paper entitled Dying Well at Home. That was a very important document.
Yes. So I suppose there's basically, you can summarise, there's four places that people die. There's hospital, hospices, nursing homes and homes. And so the Irish Hospice Foundation has done a lot of work in hospitals and in nursing homes about making the end-of-life experience a better one. And then, if you like, their next step after those two areas was to look at the question of dying well at home. And that's a really, you know, interesting area. About 20% of people will die at home in Ireland. And the number of people who say they'd like to die at home is a lot bigger than that. So there's one question, obvious question is, are there supports that you could put in place that would enable more people to die at home? You know, that brings in questions of formal care, of the delivery of out-of-hours palliative care services. That's a really interesting topic, an intense topic for many people. It has to do with the availability of, say, pain-relieving drugs out of hours. And it also, I think, has to do with the availability of informal care from family and carers.
Mm. Now, I know the national policy for palliative care will soon be published. Are you hopeful that the voices of the members in Voices for Care will be to the fore in that document?
Well, I think they'll be there to the question. I'm not sure they'll be to the fore. But it's not. It wasn't that we were pushing a particular agenda. I mean, that was, in my experience, that was a really cooperative group that we were all working on the same page. The people who were delivering palliative care, passionate about its importance, passionate about the need to improve it. Palliative care in Ireland has a good reputation. And I think it's not so much a question of, you know, tearing up the rule book and starting all over. It's a question of improving it at the margin. There are areas, for example, Midlands area doesn't have a hospice yet. That's under construction. And then, as I said, a really important issue is the availability of out of palliative care services out of hours.
Mm. Has it been rewarding for you being part of Voices for Care? And how long have you actually been with them so far?
Well, I should have only been there 4 years, but because of the pandemic, we got an extra year. So I've been there 5 years. Okay. So it has been very rewarding, John. I would strongly recommend this to anybody who's got any interest at all in palliative care. The opportunity to meet people that I wouldn't normally meet has been tremendous. The opportunity to hear of people and hear about projects in Northern Ireland as well as the Republic has been really valuable. And the All-Ireland Institute, the support you get from the Institute is really fantastic. I mean, the group is an example of a broader phenomenon called public patient involvement in healthcare. And in my experience, I think it's one of the best such examples. The support you get from the All-Ireland Institute is second to none. They're really kind, caring, they're supportive. They'll check in with you, how are you? And they'll make sure that if you want to get involved in something, you'll have an opportunity to do so.
Brilliant. I know that the applications open today, the 1st of May, and they will close on Sunday, the 16th of June. And applicants must be 18 years or over at the time of application. So clearly, if people want to get involved, the best way of doing so is to go on to the AIIHPC.org. That's the best way of doing it?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, there's a, I think their front page at the moment has a big page saying, here's how to apply. It's a fairly simple process. And again, they will, the All-Ireland Institute will have a couple of open days where they will, you know, tell you more about the Voices for Care, just to make sure that you're joining something that is going to be of some value to you.
Brilliant. Brendan Kennelly of Voices for Care, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks. Still to come this morning, we're looking at the need for greater supports for young LGBTQ plus people in Galway. Belong to join us right after these.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Visit Windsor Motor Mall Galway and get free 3-year warranty on hundreds of used cars.
Majumaha Winchna Galva, Agus Falchi Galway Talks, Lum Hain, John Morley. And I'm joined on the line by Áine E. Auglu. Áine, Majumaha Agus, Inishtum Fui on Okajata e Carlu and Yov.
Diolch, John, agus gwrm ahogod. Se, homi dy gira ar gwyne ffodfad yn heran, cwyngu le lasa yn ocht ar lawr trish yn nai, trish lŷn i greine, i gwyne ar na pas tí galeir ho maraha ag Israel yng Gaza. Mas thyr gwyl cwyg fili iwg, marav yn ish, agus byg nach fyhymile pas tí ffoc agan tish mahori, agus trochomile numar sin leonta, agus pigamid nach figuri crangiad sin istoch gwyl na fyr i gwyri nis ir de fos.
And tell me about your group and the work you're doing, because I know that the First Lady, Miss Sabina Higgins, is going to be lighting a candle with you in Ars Anuachtaran for the children of Gaza. But tell us about your group and the work you're doing.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you how we got together was when we saw the onslaught on the people of Gaza at the end of last year, we were shocked, as were most decent human people in the country, to see the extent and the brutality of the force being used by Israel against the people of that tiny little area. So most of our group are parents of young children. I'm a grandmother myself. So we got together, and initially last November, we had a get together in the local community hall where we showed that lovely documentary film, Gaza. We had an evening of poetry and music, and we managed to collect €7,500 for the Medical Aid for Palestinians charity. So we were encouraged by that. The response was overwhelming from the local people and the local businesses of that. And as the horrors kept unfolding, and you know, we were seeing these horrendous images, especially of children. It's something to do with children. You know, I think it's the lowest common denominator of humanity that you have to protect children. And seeing this genocide being live streamed into our homes, and governments that would proclaim to be democratic standing by and not only watching but enabling this to happen, we were just so horrified. We said, what can we do? We're completely powerless as a tiny little group in a small Gaeltacht area in the southeast of Ireland. What can we do? So we decided that, number one, on a solidarity and moral and just a level of making some gesture, we could light a candle and dedicate that energy and love to the children of Gaza. And then on a practical level alongside that, we've opened up a GoFundMe page, and we are making a collection For the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Mm. And that's been really, really successful. We had an initial target of €10,000 and that was surpassed quite quickly. Then we moved the target to 15 and we've still left the target at 15, but we've also surpassed that and now we're heading for 16. I haven't looked in the past hour, but it's actually coming in that quickly that we can't keep up with it. Mm. So all in all, we have been informed of at least 60 locations where people will be getting together to light candles. We're assuming that hundreds, if not thousands more, will be doing it in their homes. But yes, the most fabulous news we received about 2 weeks ago was that the President of Ireland's wife, Sabina Higgins, will be joining us this evening in lighting a candle at 9:30 in Oras an Uachtaráin. And we really look forward to getting the photograph of that so that we can post it on our social media, because we're asking people to take a photograph and share with us on social media.
Now, I know you're a Waterford Gaeltacht-based group, Gael or Son Gaza. Why not light a candle for all the children involved in this war, in terms of the Israel side and the Gaza side?
Well, there's only one group of people suffering a genocide here. And not only that, but there's a reason that we're called Gael or Son Gaza. It's because we're doing this on behalf of the children of Gaza. We feel they've been left voiceless. We feel that the might of the most allegedly democratic countries in the world is being used against them instead of in their favour. And you know, we just feel, yeah, that they're completely voiceless, completely powerless, and the people who would have us believe that they stand up for human rights throughout the world have let them down so badly. And this particular campaign is for the children of Gaza. And, you know, it's not for the children of Sudan or the children of Ukraine or anywhere else. It's just specifically this time for the children of Gaza.
A lot of people might be worried that our First Lady getting involved in this, although it is for a good cause in terms of remembering those who have been killed on one side of the conflict, that we might compromise our neutrality. What would you say to that?
Well, with respect, John, I don't view this as a conflict. I view it as a genocide. There is only one side who has, you know, if you take our average primary school in Ireland has a membership of about an affiliation of about 150 children. So with a conservative estimate of the deaths of children coming out of Gaza, you can say that the population, the entire population of at least 100 Irish primary schools has been wiped out. Mm-hmm. You can say that the population of at least 200 Irish primary schools has been injured, and the population of another probably 15 has been maimed, and many, might I add, having to have amputations without even anaesthetic, because
that.
Because Israel is blocking, it's using starvation as a weapon of war, it's using a blocking of medical aid as a weapon of war.
Okay.
So why wouldn't the First Lady empathise with them? This is nothing to do with neutrality, this is everything to do with humanity. You know, I mean, why wouldn't she? She's a very decent person who's been shown to be on the side of decency over and over again in many areas.
Yeah, I have to give the other side, though. And I know this latest round of the conflict, I know it's been going on for decades, but the latest round happened when Hamas actually attacked Israel on the 7th of October. And Israel themselves, they haven't much friends in that area when they look around them, whether that be Iran or the Houthi, Hezbollah, etc. So they're not exactly in a comfortable position either.
Yeah, well, look at, I mean, I don't want to deviate here into a discussion about the occupation of Palestine and the biggest land grab in modern times, because really we're focusing on, you know, Ireland showing love and empathy to the children of Gaza tonight. So, I mean, I think that's a whole other thing, going right back to the Balfour Declaration, you know, in the end of the last century, actually, and the whole Zionist project as it began. But, you know, Zionism can only thrive if it suppresses the Palestinian people. That's the only way in which it can thrive. And this is a huge, huge, it's a white supremacist, you know, philosophy based on oppressing other people. So, you know, if we were to have that discussion, I think, you know, I'd be very happy to come back and do that. But for the moment, I'm focusing on the positive. Like, for example, the Fórsa Trade Union in Ireland is the largest public sector union we have. It has 85,000 members. It has, its National Council has sent out a notification to all of its members encouraging them to light a candle tonight. We have people like Mary Manning, who is a legend for having stood against apartheid in South Africa. She has published a video of support for our our action. We have writers, musicians, loads and loads of public figures. And, you know, like so many people, even in New York, they're getting together today after their annual May Day parade. And they are going to be joining us. Pardon?
In Galway too.
Yes, now we have gatherings in Galway, and we're delighted to be able to say that we have a group coming together at Close Spree, Cláiste de Chonacht and Spidéal. We also have Lochatarric, if I'm correctly pronouncing it, yeah. Massrock, at the Brown Massrock sign, they're gathering there. We have students at the NUIG campus in Galway, and we have a get-together at the Square in Gort, County Galway. So if anybody is there in those areas, we'd encourage them to come along, bring their candle, and just have a silent moment, say a prayer, sing a song, play a tune, do whatever it is you do, and just bear in mind the horror that the children of Gaza and their devastated parents are going through at the moment. And that's all, just a simple gesture. I think lighting a candle is something so inherent in the Irish psyche. You know yourself, if somebody you know is doing an interview, doing an exam, if it's remembering the dead, it's, you know, we always kind of say, light a candle. Or if you can do nothing else, you know, you'd often say, I light a candle for you. So I think it's something very inherent in our culture, and it's something very simple, yet very, very powerful when so many people do it together.
Agus tá túig Balú Airgid Chomát, there's a fundraiser for this, Sonia.
Yes, there is indeed. So people will find our GoFundMe page by simply Googling GoFundMe Candles for Gaza. And we're only suggesting a donation of €5, even though some people have been incredibly generous with their donations. And just as I'm speaking to you now, John, I've opened the GoFundMe page, and I mentioned earlier that our target was 15,000. We are now standing at €16,112. Wow. So we're just extremely grateful to people. Like, Irish people are just so, so generous. And we are aware that there are so many other worthy collections there for Palestine at the moment. And, you know, we were kind of thinking, well, look, if we can make 10,000 and give it to the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, that will help the children in some way. And now 16,112, and people are coming to us with paper money as well. So it's not all going through the GoFundMe page, but we'll be delighted to inform everybody on social media when we have a final tally. And, you know, we'd ask people also to follow us on Instagram, Twitter and WhatsApp. We're Gael Erson Gaza, that's G-A-E-I-L, Erson Gaza. And we're also asking people, if they light a candle tonight, to just take a photograph or a short video and to share on social media and find us. And then if they tag us, we will re-share and, you know, we'll all link up like that.
All right. Áine E. Aulu of Gaelus and Gaza. Gnáire an Bóthairlet, and thanks for joining us on Galway Talks.
Agus gur míle maith agat d'asfair cainflet, John. Maidin maith agat glair.
Maidin wa. Now, I want to move on this morning because there's another very serious issue that crossed my desk yesterday evening. I want to discuss it with my next guest who joins me on the line in a moment. I'm going to look at some of the comments coming into us. First, John, I cannot listen to any more of this talk. Candles don't stop wars. And another listener says, all children innocent, no matter what size. Please look at both sides. So that's another comment coming in. If you want to get your comments into us, do so on our text and WhatsApp number. That's 086-3833-553. Phone Siobhan reception on 091-77-0077 and email comments at goibayfm.ie. Now, though, there's a new report on mental health of LGBTQ I plus people since 2016, which was published last week by Trinity College Dublin and Belong To. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Belong To, Monique Griffith. Monique, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on the line. Talk us through some of the findings in this mental health report.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. So the report's name is Being LGBTQI Plus in Ireland. As you said, it's a new piece of research and carried out by the team at Trinity College Dublin, led by Professor Agnes Higgins in the School of Midwifery and Nursing there. And it builds on a previous similar study in 2016, which was the first comprehensive report on mental health of LGBT community in Ireland, of its size. size, and it involved over 2,800 people and included in comparative analysis with this 2016 report. So it focuses, as you said, on the mental health as well as the attitudes of the general public in Ireland towards LGBT people, and it covers a wide range of statistics on the levels of stress, anxiety, depression, eating disorder, self-harm, suicidal thoughts and suicidal attempts.
Now the report found that since 2016 the mental health of Ireland's young LGBTQI plus people has deteriorated. Is there any, like, I suppose, suggestion as to why that is?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite shocking, isn't it? You think you'd be thinking things would be getting better. And for many, especially in the older cohort, over 25s, things like progressive legislation, inclusive legislation, marriage equality, gender recognition, equality legislation, all that kind of stuff is mentioned, and in terms of attitudes of people and a greater feeling of acceptance and inclusion is mentioned. But for younger people, you know, under 23, especially the 14 to 18 year olds, and trans and gender non-conforming people, their mental health and well-being has substantially declined. And we think from what they've said, or what we know, sorry, for what they said, is it's a combination of the increase in violence and bullying and exclusion that they're experiencing, and that is directly linked with the rise in anti-LGBT messaging and attitudes online that have now normalized those kinds of that language and attitudes and behavior, and then that spills over into the real life, you know, and in schools, on the streets, and a feeling of not being safe, fear of bullying, fear of being physically attacked, even sexual assault in some cases described. So that, of course, gets internalized and affects somebody's, very, very obviously then can affect somebody's mental health and well-being.
Because there has been a pushback. I know that the new hate speech bill, that looks like it's now shelved, and a lot of the mainstream parties have been called out by their own backbenchers for going too far to the progressive left. Have you noticed that, or is this a big part of it? At the end of the day, these people we're talking about here, Monique Griffiths, it's people's lives here. It's not a political football.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this is it. I think the majority of Irish people, when you look at the public attitudes, the majority of Irish people are very supportive of lesbian, gay, bisexual people, less so around trans and gender non-conforming. And I think that it's very obvious from the research, because they asked people, you know, did they know anyone who's trans? And for the people who did know somebody who's trans, their level of comfort, I suppose, and their acceptance of trans people was way higher. So the reality is that there are far fewer. It's a smaller community, so a smaller number of trans people live in Ireland or in the world globally. So there's, you know, sometimes it's less likely that we will know somebody who's trans in our family or in our community. So it really is up to us to educate ourselves as good citizens, as good members of our communities, to learn about what it means to be trans, what it's like to live in Ireland at the moment as trans, so that we can stand up for people living in our communities, in our towns, who are trans and who are feeling this hate, even though it mightn't be from you and me, but it's online, and therefore there's a fear that they will experience this from people in their community when they're out and about just living their lives.
And is it also a fear of the unknown? You mentioned there the people that haven't met anyone who is trans or non-binary, etc. Visibility is an important part of this. I know that in terms of the Eurovision, we have Bambi Thug who identifies as non-binary. So maybe over time in visibility, will it get better, do you think?
Well, but that's what we're hoping. At the moment, in some cohorts of the media, there's just a lot of very toxic visibility. So fear-mongering and, you know, dehumanization of trans people. We need lots more, you know, just stories of and visibility of ordinary trans folks living here in Ireland who are just trying to live their lives like you and me. And I think when, like we did around the marriage equality referendum, where we saw ordinary gay and lesbian couples and families, you know, living in their communities. And we got to understand and accept and love LGBT people in our community. We need to do that now with our trans family members and co-workers and people living in our communities. We need to get to know them and make sure that they know that they are accepted, included and loved.
Final point, are government doing enough in this regard? Because we know that mental health services have been lacking in certain quarters, particularly look at the likes of CAMHS and that. Do government need to do more?
Definitely. We need to really redouble our efforts in relation to a lot of the work that's already underway. We need way more mental health supports, obviously, and we need healthcare for trans people. Currently, there's nothing available if you're under 18 in terms of healthcare for trans people. And can be very, can leave people hopeless, young people and their parents hopeless in terms of getting the support they need. The other thing that was really came out strong is the need for community spaces. So wonderful resources like Amok in Galway were named as really important spaces for LGBTQI people to meet, to make community, to find friends, to learn about their history, their culture, and get the support and services they need, and to be able to celebrate, you know, things like Pride, Broad, you know, all these kind of parts of LGBT, the LGBT calendar. That make us easy, you know, help us self-accept and then become to love ourselves and celebrate who we are.
All right, Monique Griffith, the CEO of Belong To, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you.
Now, though, I want to change tack this morning because I want to give you all a chance to win today, because there's a very big event happening. It's happening this weekend. It is the Connacht GAA Championship, and the big question is, will Galway beat Mayo? The Galway senior football team take on Mayo in this year's Connacht GAA Championship final on Sunday at 4 o'clock in Pearse Stadium. The Tribes will be bidding for 3 in a row Connacht titles against their age-old rival. Supporters are advised to buy their tickets in advance. Tickets are available from gaa.ie/tickets or at selected Super Value and Central stores. No tickets are on sale at the venue on the day. Connacht GAA, where we all belong. We're giving you the chance to win a pair of tickets for the Terrace in Pearse Stadium this Sunday. All you have to do is text in Galway now to 086 38 33 553. That's Galway to 086 38 33 553. Do so straight away. We'll be announcing the winner before the end of today's programme. Coming up next, we're talking to John Lannan, who is the CEO of Durris, about the whole migration situation. It's taken a turn this week. That's coming up now.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Find hundreds of used cars to suit your budget in Windsor Motor Mall Galway, located on the Monave Road.
Good morning, you're listening to Galway Talks with John Morley. We're looking at the whole migrant, refugee and asylum seeker situation right now, because I'm joined on the line by John Lannan, who is the CEO of Durris. And Durris are an independent organisation working to promote and protect the rights of people from a migrant background here in Ireland. John, good morning. Just take me through your thoughts from a Durris point of view, the scenes the last few days, whether that be the emergency legislation here in Ireland as a reaction to the Rwanda policy in the UK. It's become very tense.
Indeed, good morning. It has become very tense politically. There's a lot of talk about asylum seekers and refugees being sent in both directions over and back across the border. I think the first thing that is really important to say is that we're not just talking about numbers or goods here. This is about people who have rights, who've often risked a lot, maybe even their lives, in attempts to reach safety. It's about people who've been traumatised perhaps by their experiences, possibly suffering greatly in their journeys either to the UK or to Ireland. We've also got to bear in mind that the UK is now a very hostile place for anyone seeking asylum. Seen a worsening over the last while, particularly now with the intended policy of sending people to Rwanda. This is something that the UK Supreme Court ruled was unlawful, finding that that country was unsafe under international law, and then they passed a new law to declare that it was in fact safe. So in the light of all of that, in the light of the fact that they're much more broadly, their Illegal Immigration Act makes it virtually impossible for a lot of people to apply for asylum, it's not surprising that some people have to resort to coming to Ireland to seek protection and safety. And again, then it's really important to recognise that everybody has a right to do that. Anybody who applies for international protection is legally entitled to do so. But we're in a situation now where the political discussions over people coming across the border from the UK and whether their application should be deemed admissible or not has become a hot topic, with the government here in Ireland now proposing to enact emergency legislation to overturn a ruling of a Supreme Court, essentially, that happened last March, which said that people could not be returned to the UK.
Is the elephant in the room here, though, that the UK government, their claim is that they're trying to stop illegal immigration into their country, and the elephant in the room being the double movement of asylum seekers?
Well, we've got to be careful about what we're talking about when we talk about illegal. Again, under international law, and, you know, everybody has a right to seek international protection. There may be movements of people who choose not to seek international protection. There may be others who are not given the opportunity to do that, even though they wish to do so. And as I said, that the UK has become quite a hostile environment. The UK's Refugee Council did an assessment there recently where they said that as many as 250,000 people could be detained or left destitute in state-provided accommodation, and that would or could include up to 40 or 50,000 children. So we see a situation where, you know, worldwide or globally, there are over 100 million people now forcibly displaced from their homes as a result of wars and persecution and the destruction of the environment, largely by what, as a result of what our own Western governments have done. There's a tendency or a move towards shutting down of the routes that people have to move, particularly into the European countries. There's also, I'd have to say, a weaponizing of migration as an issue as we're coming up to elections. And that's a really, you know, that is a reality. That's what's happening in the UK right now. And unfortunately, we see some elements of that here in Ireland as well, where migration has been kind of touted as one of the big issues. And really, that's distracting from the real issues, which are housing, the lack of services that communities across the country, not just here, but also in the UK, face.
Do we not have to enforce the current rules we do have in place, though? The likes of the Dublin regulation, is that not a fair point? That, like, France is a safe country. Why are people crossing the UK channel in boats to get the English channel to get over to the UK? Do we not just need to enforce the rules we currently have?
Well, we do enforce the rules. We have an international protection office that takes all applications for asylum here in Ireland and processes those. Not everybody is granted refugee status. Some are, given leave to remain under other grounds. But, we have legislation that meets many of our obligations under international law. It's not without its flaws, but it provides a basis upon which applications for asylum are assessed. If we're looking at what are called secondary movements, if we look at the fact that people are moving potentially from one country in Europe to another, you're right that there are mechanisms like the Dublin regulations that in some circumstances permit the or allow for the return of people to another country in Europe. Those conditions or could be that if they have spent a significant amount of time in an...
We appear to have lost contact with John Lennon. We might get him back up on a different line there, if you don't mind, Sean. Just if you want to get your comments in on this issue, or do we have you back, John?
Hello?
Yeah, I think we have you back now, John. You were saying about the double movements.
Yes, I'm saying that, you know, we have people who may have arrived in one country of Europe, moved to another one to seek international protection. There are mechanisms that allow for people to be returned in certain circumstances, like the Dublin regulation that you mentioned. Those circumstances would include things like if they had spent a significant amount of time in another European country, if they had already made an application for asylum in another country, or if they had if they had family members in another country. But it doesn't mean that everybody who comes through another European country must be returned to that country, and that's not in fact what happens.
What do you make of the scenes outside the IPO offices in Dublin today?
Well, first of all, you know, we have had a situation here in the country where the government had been failing to meet its obligations under the Reception Conditions Directive, which essentially means providing basic shelter and food to people who come here seeking protection. Over 1,700 people left without accommodation, many hundreds of them in the tents in Mount Street. Very unsanitary, very unsafe. From what we hear of what's happening there now, it sounds like a positive move. It's good that people are being moved to some place where there are showers, there is sanitary facilities, there are other basic amenities for people. We don't know the details of where they're going yet, but as I said, you know, almost anything would be better than having to spend time on a flimsy tent in an unsafe and unsanitary environment on a concrete pavement.
And there's a lot of speculation about where these people have been moved to, but we've seen unsavoury scenes across the country. People need to realise that these are very vulnerable people who, you know, they're not just here for the sake of it.
Absolutely, yes. People are here seeking protection, seeking safety because they have to. Nobody gets up, leaves their home, risks their life and maybe their children's lives crossing the Mediterranean or the Channel in a very flimsy boat just for the sake of it. They do so because it's better than the alternatives. And when people come to Ireland, they have that right to seek protection here. We've seen, sadly, seen quite violent reactions to asylum seekers and migrants here in Ireland of late. And that's a really worrying and really disappointing thing to see in Ireland, a country that has been so welcoming for so many years and has welcomed so many people and been welcomed in so many places around the world. But it's also really important here to for politicians to ensure that they act and that they speak responsibly. You know, they need to be clear about everybody's rights to come here. They need to ensure that people know that there is a process here from jury through which people go to assess their application for asylum and that process, not without its flaws, but it is a system that meets most of our international obligations. Yeah. So, you know, again, this the discourse around migration and the weaponizing of migration is a really worrying trend. And it is, as I said, distracting from the real issues that we have, which are a lack of housing for all. We've got depletion of services like school resources, medical facilities, transport in our towns and villages.
John Lennon, the CEO of Dura, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks. We're coming back after news and talking about the issue of planning in the east of Galway City after these.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Visit Windsor Motor Mall Galway on the Monavay Road, a new way to car shop.